Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now, Season 3. I'm your host, Keith Mavidi-Gensini. Today I'm talking with my dear friend, Anita Hollander, who is the current natural chair of SAG-AFTRA Performers with Disabilities. Anita, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Keith.
So I met you a few years ago when I saw your marvelous one-woman show, one-woman musical show, Spectacular Falls. Talk a bit about that.
Well, we did actually meet before that at someone
Okay.
else's show, and I'm blanking on her name. Unfortunately, she's not with us anymore, but we happened to sit next to each other.
Christina Bruno.
No, it was somebody.
Oh.
It was I will find the name, but
Oh,
she was doing
Christina.
an opera, an op and like an opera, one person solo opera about her experiences in life. And she had had many operations and sang like a bird. And I was asked to be her interviewer at, in the talk back after the show. It was down.
Amy.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear that she's no longer with us.
Yes, it
That
was scary.
explains why I can't get her for an interview, which is
Yes.
a shame.
Yes, very, very sad to lose her, but a very fortunate thing that I got to meet her before she passed away, and to see her show. And she has a book that, so she has a legacy. But we were sitting next to each other during the show, and I was like, "Why don't I know you? Why haven't I met you?" And it was so great to meet you then. And fortunately, that sort of led to you coming to see Spectacular Falls at the United Solo Festival off Broadway. And that show is my second solo musical, original solo musical, the first one being called Still Standing. And so I go from Still Standing to Spectacular Falls. And I'm actually working on a third to make it a trilogy, which will be called Balance, a Footnote. Which sort of puts the whole thing together of standing, falling, and what I've learned in all of those experiences. The truth is that I began writing solo musicals because, as a disabled performer, even though I did work quite a lot, there were big gaps between theater gigs and TV gigs and film gigs. And in those gaps, it was important for me to be performing, being out there. And at first, in the 80s, when I first moved to New York, I was doing cabaret, performing in cabarets like Don't Tell Mama and 88s and the Duplex all over town and getting a lot of good press. But and I was showcasing music written by the people that I was in a workshop with at BMI, one of the two licensing agencies, BMI and ASCAP. That they are the people who send you your residuals and your royalties when your music is played. And BMI, Broadcast Music Incorporated, I think is the full name. They were people like Lynn Ahrens and Steve Flaherty, the guys who wrote Ragtime, and people who now their names are out there all the time, but we were all sort of studying and working together. And I would take the songs I learned from that they wrote in the workshop and put them on the stage in cabarets, which is my way of giving back, was like, I'll perform your songs because I was performing them anyway in class. So after doing cabaret, performing in cabarets for a long time, I just, it's a really tough, it's not easy. and you're always drumming up an audience and all that stuff. I thought, well, wait a minute. I'm in a writer's workshop. I was accepted into this writer's workshop. I should be writing about things I know. And I started writing about my life because my life was an interesting story. So that's how Still Standing came about. And it became a solo show, not because I intended it to be. It was going to be a whole musical with a cast. But I realized it's so hard to get a musical up and running. And when you have a disability, to get anybody to even like help you do that in the 80s and the 90s. So instead, I condensed it to be a one-woman show. And at first, I did it in cabarets. I did it at Don't Tell Mamas in 1993. And I had a backup vocals and band, and they played all the other characters. And then when I started getting asked to do the show out of town, I recorded all of them, the voices, the band, and took it on the road. So Still Standing, I've been doing since 1993. I recorded the album in 1996. Well, years went by, and it seemed to me it was time to do a new show because I had grown. I had lived my life. I had gone on doing things, so I had more to say. And I have a lot to say about where we are as a country right now. And also, one thing I was very well acquainted with is falling. And then I started thinking about the many meanings of the word fall and falling. I mean, it's a season. It's the downfall or fall through the cracks or fall in love. I mean, there's so many meanings of that word. So just me falling, it started with me falling and breaking my right hand. And because I have one leg and I walk on one leg in crutches, breaking a hand is not a good idea. And that's when I started to get these ideas of doing a show all about falling. And one of the most important thing was don't fall for crap. Don't fall for crap. And that's one of my favorite songs in the show because we've been living in a time where we get fed a lot of crap out there. And it was 2019, before we even knew what we were headed into as far as a pandemic, we had to deal with a president that was driving us in the way wrong direction. And there was a lot of crap around. So that is also in the show. Falling from grace, falling head over heels. I mean, just so many things. And it turned out to be so many songs that it became a show. And I love doing that show. And Keith, I love the fact that you saw it. And of course, we headed at the end of 2019, after I premiered Spectacular Falls, I was invited to go to South Korea, to Seoul, to do Still Standing, the first show, which I did get to do. And it was a revelation to do my first show for an audience of disabled and non-disabled people in a beautiful theater in the theater district of Seoul, Korea. Yes, there is one, and it's very active. It was an incredible experience. And on my flight home in December of 2019, the woman next to me was coughing up a storm. And the staff had said, just know she's not well. A few weeks later, I was back in New York in January, and I got sick, but I didn't know what it was. And by February, it was clear, pretty clear what it had been, because by March of 2020, we were locked down. So my shows and the history of what we're going through always reflect each other. And that's all. I'm hoping my third one will be another way of looking at things as well. But perspective, it's about so many things. And that was a really long answer to talk about Spectacular Falls. But if anyone wants to hear it or see anything about it, there's YouTube and Spotify and all of those websites have it. You just look up Spectacular Falls or Still Standing and Anita Hollander. Always write Anita Hollander after it because a lot of other things are called Still Standing. And in fact, there are other things called Spectacular Falls. Ah, well.
Yes, I actually, sorry about that. I actually saw Spectacular Falls two or three times, because I was very envious that you wrote a song called Kids on Cornelia Street that
Oh.
I simply fell head over heels. But I remember meeting you after the first show and saying that should have been a Leonard Cohen song. It's that good. And that song is why I got the CD. And yeah, so, but
Oh,
yeah.
thank you. I love that song. Thank you so much. I love singing it, and I love how the recording came out of it too. And you're welcome to play it on your podcast just so people can hear that song, because I do love, I'm so glad you like that song. I love it.
Well, I love every song in Spectacular Falls because it's so apt. It's so apt and true to the disability experience and the use of humor to convey that experience, like the title track and then Banana Peel Away, and every song it's a hook in keeping the audience engaged in your story. And I was able to watch a lot of the show right before this episode, including Kids on Cornelia Street. And that took me back to, as you said, the before times. And so I'm really glad you're writing a trilogy, a third act, because it's very important. We actually performed together at Theater Breaking Through Barriers,
We did it, yes.
actually. We were in a harrowing
Yes.
short play called Teacher's Pet. I could talk all day about that, but I wanted to get your perspective because I was very brand new, just getting my feet wet, as it were. What was that experience like?
Keith, the fact that we got pulled from a lottery hat, just pulled, our names were pulled out of the hat, because that's the Theater Breaking Through Barriers Playwrights Intensive. Whether they went online when we had the pandemic, but before that it used to be live. But the going online meant that anyone, anywhere, could end up being part of doing a play together, even if you were somewhere in another country. You could still do a play together, and you'd have an audience from all over the globe. It expanded theater breaking through barriers so immensely. But the fact, but when they pick the cast and they pick a director and they pick a playwright, it's all random. It's because they want it that way. They want to throw people together, the artists together, and see what they come up with. And the artistic director of the theater of Theater Breaking Through Barriers, Nicholas Vaselli, this was his brainchild, and he wanted to see what artists would do. And at first he wasn't sold on the idea of doing this virtually, because plays are meant to be live in front of people right there. That spontaneity of the audience sitting there and actors there and totally understood that. But so he sort of grudgingly said, well, we've got to keep ourselves going. And we had a grant, the theater company had a grant. It's like, let's just go ahead and see how it goes. Well, he was thrilled. He was totally thrilled how this virtual Playmakers intensive worked out. And so were all of us. And Keith, how would it have been? We would have never probably been just out of the blue cast to be in a play together. We were at different ends of our careers, different ends of our lives, different types of everything. It was a very rare occurrence, but oh, how great it was, because we got thrown together with one other actor and a playwright who's South American, I believe. And the director, Richard Rose, he was over here. And we had people all over the globe, literally. We had one of us was in California, I believe. One of us was in Florida. One of us was in New York. One of us was in Italy or traveling around. Our other actor, because of the pandemic and his wife was French, they kept moving through the Alps. They'd be in France one day, then they'd be in Italy. So he kept moving around. And then there was one other location too. Was it New England? I think none of us were in the same city. And yet, the wonderful playwright I'm sure you know the name,
Enrique.
Yes, he wrote this horror play, this sort of horror movie kind of play, very scary, not the kind of stuff I do like ever. I don't know if I've ever done a play like it. But because we were in our own little spaces, we could create our own set. And in my case, I could turn all the lights off. I mean, this is an audio interview, but if you saw me on Zoom, you'd see I'm in my living room. Well, I turned all the lights off. We were doing it at night and put like one spotlight in my face. And I became this kind of ghostly character that was harassing you, your character. And oh my, the whole thing was so interesting. And Enrique took into account where each of us was, what kind of place we were, it was an amazing experience. And I have to say, Keith, for something, horror movies are not my thing and horror plays, not my thing. But I realized being the bad guy in a horror film is so much fun, and I didn't ever really appreciate it. So I really loved doing it and loved doing it with you. And it gave us like a lifelong relationship, friendship, because we got to really experiment with what we could do. And your acting was wonderful, Keith. And I don't think I was aware at the time that this was the first dipping your toe into this idea. You were really wonderful, and you were perfectly, he wrote that role for you, so you were perfectly cast. The reason he wrote me as a scary, horrible person was because I loved what he said. He said the nicest actors he's ever worked with always make the greatest bad guys, villain.
True.
And it turned out so much fun to be just so evil. I mean, I scared myself, but didn't we have a great time, Keith?
Yes. Yeah. So that wasn't my true first dip. I had acted with Theater Breaking Through Barriers once in 2019 at my first Playmakers Intensive.
I see.
And then I was in Arizona at the time. James was in France. You were here. Richard was here. I was very intimidated working with such high caliber actors, but also because I had to play a paranoid schizophrenic with
Yes.
bipolar tendencies who couldn't deal with guilt, and shame. And I was none of those things in real life. And how I did that is I left therapy for 2 weeks and just let my demons rise to the surface. And I'm not making light of that at all. That would judge the process. And I actually got reteamed with Enrico and Richard Rhodes, my next play, and Fred
Wow.
Babkitz joined us, and Kate Allen wrote a marvelous
Yes.
lockdown play, very male-oriented, called Mended, in MEN, all capitalized. And you're right. I interviewed Nick Vercelli last season. He's one of the most wonderful people I've met. So, for those who are listening who don't know your history as a disability performer and who have not yet have had the chance to Google or watch your work, give us a brief overview of how did the acting and musical performer, quote unquote, bug first bite you?
Oh, great question. Great question. And I'll try to condense this. I came out of the womb wanting to perform, so much so that I jumped out of my crib when I was 1 year old. Literally jumped out, like piled up my stuffed animals and jumped out of the crib and got a concussion, which is probably why I chose acting as a profession, because, I broke my brain. But no, I didn't. I had a concussion though. By the time I was four, I was getting up and performing when my parents didn't even know I was. I would get out of an audience and go up to the stage and perform. So by the time I was eight, my parents said, "Well, she's going to be doing this. Let's help her." And they took me to my first audition, and I got the job, which was understudying Gretel in The Sound of Music, the youngest child in The Sound of Music, at a professional at an equity theater in Cleveland, Ohio, where I lived. And the little girl who was playing the role was kind enough to get German measles over a weekend, and I got to go on the whole weekend for her, which well, that was it. As far as I was concerned, my first professional acting job at 8 years old taught me what the high standards are, what it's like to not just do any theater, but professional theater. And a year later, Sound of Music had been, it was very new to everybody. This was 1964. The show had been on Broadway, but it had not been in regional theaters. And this was one of the first regional productions with Broadway cast and Broadway musical director and Broadway director. And this was me at 8 years old going, "This is where I belong. This is exactly what I was looking for." So that it was so popular that the next year, that next summer, this was music in a tent, a theater, professional equity theater in a tent in the round. That was my introduction to theater professionally. And a year later, they brought the show back. And because I had grown 2 inches, they let me have a role to myself. I played Marta, the second child. So that was my very first experience. And from then on, my standards were where I thought they should be, which were Broadway standards. My dad was a Broadway enthusiast. By the time I was four, I was singing and dancing to every Broadway show that came out in my living room. Before I went to kindergarten or anything, I knew Guys and Dolls, and I knew Fiorello, My Fair Lady, all of these shows that were the late 50s, early 60s. I mean, it was that time when Broadway was major, so much going on, and there was always a new show, and my dad would bring home the album, and then eventually he was taking us once a year to New York to see shows. And that was what I was aiming towards. That's Mr. Rogers used to say that child's play is a rehearsal for adulthood. And I had the whole first floor of our house in Cleveland mapped out as 42nd Street. Here's my apartment. There's the elevator. There's the street. There's the theater. There's the recording studio. Everything was mapped out in the ground floor of my house. And I would play the albums of the music. My mother would put on the records of the Broadway shows, and I would act out the shows. And in between, when they were flipping another record, I would go to my so-called New York apartment. I had it all figured out. But I was only 4 years old. And that the reason I think I knew all of that, because 40 years later, I was living on 43rd Street here in Manhattan in Hell's Kitchen, a block around the corner was Theater Breaking Through Barriers and off Broadway. And a few blocks to the east was Times Square and all the Broadway theaters. So I wasn't wrong. When I was four, I was rehearsing for what my adult life would be. And Mr. Rogers was right. But I didn't learn that till I had a child. And I heard him say it. And I went, you know, he's right. He's totally right. But there's a part of me also that's interesting that would explain also why I have the, as you said, been bit by the acting bug, is that my grandmother was on vaudeville. She performed with the Robert Circuit. Like there's a Schubert circuit, there are different circuits of touring. And she was a dancer in vaudeville who would tour the country. And she died 6 years before I was born of cancer. She was very young. She was 44 years old. She died 6 years before I was born. I was born looking exactly like her and grew to every stage of my life. The pictures of her and the pictures of me were the same person. And my mother, she kept saying, "You look like my mom. You look so much like my mom." Well, there was a reason why I was ready to start a career at the age of four and then did at age of eight, because I believe I am her reincarnated. How would I have known all the things I knew if it wasn't somewhere in my DNA that her life was cut short and I continued it? I jumped out of my crib because I had places to go and people to see. I know this may sound a little too weird for some of your listeners, but if you look at pictures of her and pictures of me, same person. And it's been a very exciting journey. I have three sisters, and my husband and I were just talking about this, who looks like which parents and all that. And I am the one of my family who just picked up all of my mother's and my mother's mother's DNA. And interestingly enough, I'm the one person in the family who got cancer at a young age. And I got cancer at 21. And I was at Carnegie Mellon University, and it was in my leg. And they did an operation. They took out it, the cancer was in my motor nerve, my sciatic nerve. They took out the motor nerve. I still had a leg, but due to radiation and chemotherapy, and 5 years later, I had a pretty messed up leg, which and a recurrence. So when I was 26, my leg was amputated. And 4 weeks after the amputation, I opened in a show in Boston. And this is another reason for the answer to that question is only a person who was like born in a trunk, only a person who had been doing this since their last lifetime probably would have been had the confidence to just say, okay, I lost my leg, but I have to get back to rehearsals. 2 weeks after the amputation, I was back at rehearsals. I was also directing the show. I was in it and I was directing. It was Jacques Brel is alive and well and living in Paris, but this production was in Boston, fortunately, where Mass General Hospital is. So I had the best doctors' teams, and I had the best care, and they let me go LOA, LOA, leave of absence every evening to do my rehearsals, come back. And I was on one leg. I had never been on one leg, but I had for 5 years been living with a paralyzed leg, which had no motor nerve in it. And I had toured Europe with that leg, with that real leg, with a brace on that leg. And I had worked all over the place. What I'm saying is, bottom line is, I think only a person who has this running through their veins could just say, okay, fine, I'll do it on one leg. Or okay, fine, I'll figure out how to use an artificial leg and I'll do the show on crutches and an artificial leg. So I did. So those are all the answers to your questions of it started maybe before I was even born.
Well, not a lot of people get any of that to experience any of that to get reincarnated and continue a life. That's fascinating. You mentioned that you have a family. And Kids on Canoyard Street tells the love story of a relationship that doesn't work out. You mentioned you have kids, so eventually you did find love.
Yes. He's sitting right behind me. Yes. Yes, that Kiss on Cornelia Street was before all of that. It was my first year in New York before I even met my husband. It was a playwright, and it was an amazing experience. But then the real love of my life came along, and he's been with me for is it 36 years? 36 and a half
36,
years.
37.
Yeah. Hang on a second. I just have to check something. All right. Oh, my battery is weird. Anyways.
So, when your children, you mentioned one, wanted to follow in your footsteps. As a performer, how did that make you feel? Were you really excited, or did you? And I can't imagine that, but I'll ask it anyway. Did you try to talk them out of it?
How do you know that, Keith? That's hilarious that you know that.
I really don't.
I think that's pretty funny. Because my daughter likes to tell people that every profession that she wanted to do was. Sorry, I just fixed my computer. Every profession that she wanted to do, somebody in my family would say, oh, don't do that. Like, oh, maybe I should be a lawyer. My sister, the lawyer, said, no, you don't want to do that. Our adopted sister, she was like, well, maybe I should be a writer. My writer, our adopted sister, she was, no, you don't want to do that. And theater or the show business, as they say, or this industry, we were saying, listen, if that's what you want to do, we will support you on that. But honestly, it's not the best thing you could do for yourself. And because I only have one daughter, and she's extremely smart, and she's passionate about education. Again, has been since she was 3 years old and setting up classrooms where I was setting up theaters in the living room. She was setting up classrooms. She was very into learning and teaching, and she was incredibly smart. She always impressed us at how smart she was. She also picked up the talents from her genes, the genes that she came into life with. She was singing before she was speaking, just because it was all around her. I mean, she'd be sitting through my rehearsals in the living room for a cabaret show. She'd be coming to the theater a lot. At 3 years old, she was really come. She came to see some of our shows. We were taking her to Broadway when she was three because she was so well behaved, even though they said nobody under five can come into this Broadway theater. They let her because she was so well behaved. She would sit through whole shows at the public theater. She would be down in the green room, hanging out with Bill Irwin, and I would be on stage. And it was something she knew since before she could even have a memory of life. She was already in it. Oh, and at 5 weeks old, she was on All My Children. As if anyone out there is listening and knows All My Children, there was a character named Barbara. And Barbara had two boyfriends, and they didn't know she had a baby named Molly Rose, and nobody knew which one of them was the father. Well, the baby was played by Holland Hamilton, our daughter. And the reason for that is that both my husband and I had been doing All My Children, had been on All My Children, the soap opera, for many times. And we knew casting people. And when I was pregnant, they said, "When are you due?" I said, "September 27th." They said, "Call us the minute the baby's born because Barbara is having a baby on the show and we're going to need a baby." And sure enough, about 2 weeks after she was born, my sister and I brought her to the casting office and they shined a bright light on her and she was not fazed in the least by it, didn't bother her at all. And they were like, "Well, that's the audition. We just needed to know she'd be bothered by the lights." And she just kept going about her business. So she was already professional before I was. I was 8, she was 5 weeks old when the first episode of All My Children showed Holland Hamilton. It was so early in her life that the family out in Cleveland and Michigan, his family, my family, none of them had seen a picture of her because in 1989, we didn't have cameras, phone cameras. You had to actually have a film camera. Or when you took pictures of a baby, you had to get it developed and then you could send it by snail mail to the family. Well, we were in the throes of our first and only pregnancy, we had a baby and we couldn't be bothered with that. So instead, the family out in the country and the rest of the country saw Holland for the first time, saw a picture of her on national television on a soap opera. So she didn't have a lot of choice back then that she was already in the industry. She was already making her college funds as a baby. But the truth is, as we went along, she loved singing. The song I wrote for her, Mommy is a Mermaid, was immortalized on the Today Show because they did a feature about me when she was a baby and on me and my husband and my daughter at the piano. I was playing Mommy's a Mermaid and there she was having a bottle and every so often singing a little bit along with it. And by the time she was 4 years old, we were sitting her on a piano and she was singing Mommy is a Mermaid. So she really It was a part of her life that she did enjoy doing it. But one thing she really, really was passionate about was education. And what she hated in life was constant competition, auditions. She just thought it was horrible that 300 people were going to audition for one role and only one person was going to get the job. She was up for the lead in Hairspray, for over a year, they kept calling her in on Broadway. And she was called for the Sound of Music on Broadway, a revival of the Sound of Music, which I thought was very funny. She would go up, she would be called in to be seen for these things. And then when she did not get it, or like a Kodak commercial, she was called in for. She's 4 years old and she learned the script. She learned the copy. It was a little monologue. She learned it overnight. Few months later, we're sitting in the living room, and on the TV comes the Kodak commercial. And I see her not looking at the TV, But I see her stop what she's doing. She was playing. And when the commercial was over, she kept going. And I could tell in her face, it didn't seem fair to her. And as she went on, she did summer stock. She didn't want to, she went to professional performing arts school, and she was performing all the time. She was the voice of VH1 Save the Music. She, if you look on Facebook, she spoke to Tony Bennett in a show on VH1. I mean, she had a great voice. She read copy, so she was the voice. If you called VH1 Save the Music campaign, you would hear fifth grade Holland telling, saying hello to everybody and telling them, you know, press one if you want this, press two. And then she would answer frequently asked questions. She was great at it. And she got work in Maine. She got work in Chicago, Detroit. She wrote her own show. But in the end, and at Oberlin, where she went, they talked her into being in the theater department, but she really wanted to do African American studies. And she went to Africa. That was her major. And she spent 4 months there. And she, anything Holland would set her mind to, she was very good at. But in the end, she was passionate about teaching, passionate. And that's what she does now. And now she also has a baby of her own who she has very clearly said, I'm not making any choices for my baby. My baby will make her own choices. And I think that's great. I think that's great. I mean, she knows that the money she got from her very early acting experience really did end up being the savings for her college experiences, which she loved. But she got her master's in education. She married a wonderful guy who's up for his PhD at MIT, also passionate about education. He's a media arts person, and they love education. And she's also done stuff for the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, on teaching hard history for second graders. She's done a template of how you can teach hard history to young people, which is not traumatizing, but lets them see what the world is like. I mean, I think she's chosen, that was her chosen passion. And it was all her. She made these decisions herself. Much as she loves to sing, we still sing together all the time, any chance we get. And when we can perform together, for sure. And all of those experiences that she got performing and working backstage of Broadway shows, she has used, and writing plays for MCC Youth Company. All of this she has used in her education work. She's really taken all that creativity and made learning exciting and fun for kids in elementary school. She's also run preschool programs. I will tell you one last thing about her, because you know, moms can go on forever about their kids, but the thing I love most is that she always invites me into her world. She'll say, Mom, can you come up to Massachusetts? I'm teaching kids about growth mindset, how maybe you can't do something today, but it's just that you can't do it yet. There's always a chance you will learn how to do it. So come and show us how you learned how to walk on one leg and an artificial leg, and let's watch the Today Show thing. And I mean, she brings me into her world, and a mother can't ask for better than that. And I think she's made so much the right choice for her path. It's her path, not my path, not our path.
You have an incredible family. I believe you also have a son.
No, I don't.
Oh,
Oh, I know why you think so.
yeah,
Another
yeah.
thing about being in the center of New York City, living in Manhattan Plaza, I nurture a lot of young up-and-coming folks and a lot of Holland's best friends, close friends. We live in Manhattan Plaza, full of artists and art, not just performing artists, but writers, composers, designers, visual artists, musicians, everything. And the kids of those people, of course, become friends. And I've become a mother of many, many wonderful artists and people in general in New York. And I'm New York mother to a lot of folks who have a real mother in like Texas and Detroit and all across the country, but I'm their other mother. And what's really lovely is that one of those New York sons is Andy Einhorn, who is a Broadway conductor and musical director, who we did Cats together and Showboat together. We did many shows together when he was just starting out before he moved to New York. We did it in Summerstock. And when he came to New York, I said, "Well, you can come stay with us until you get settled." And I became his New York mom, and his Texas mom was totally happy with that. She was like, "Great, I love it." And so to this day, I see him as my son. And one of my daughter's best friends from the MCC Playwright program, he's my other son. And so I know it must sound like I have tons of children, but I kind of do. I'm very glad that they let me be their mom in Midtown, their Midtown mom.
So you mentioned early on that you launched leg in your late 20s. So
Yes.
how was getting readapted or adapting to moving around,
Right. I had to learn how to.
beginning that process? Because I know how you move, particularly how you dance in spectacular falls, but take us through that whole process,
Great. Another
if you
great
will.
question. Yeah, because the first disability happened when I was 21, when they took the motor nerve out of my leg. So with a brace on my leg, I went back to Carnegie Mellon 6 weeks after that surgery, determined that I would graduate with my class. It was junior year, and I was determined to catch up with them and graduate with them, which I did, but I had to get through a stage fighting combat, stage combat examination. And I'm sure they would have still graduated me if I hadn't done it, but I was totally determined. And I did, and I was able to do that. I had to learn how to walk. My first surgery was here in New York, even though I lived in Cleveland, but I had to be sent to somebody special at the Neurological Institute because the idea of having cancer in a nerve hadn't gotten around to the country. Nobody knew even that that existed. But one doctor in New York City knew of one case of neurofibrosarcoma. So I was in New York, where I wanted to live anyways, but not in a hospital. But I had to relearn how to walk without being able to feel my left leg. And within a year, I was in London performing and dancing on on this plastic brace. But fortunately, the people at LAMDA, London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, when I auditioned for them in my senior year at Carnegie Mellon, they were fascinated with me having a brace on their leg. First of all, UK has been ahead of us with performers with disabilities the whole way through. They actually respect people for their talent. And if they have a disability, well, so much the more interesting to that'll make you. Of course, they also age well naturally. And this makes you more interesting as you can. I love London and I love the UK for the fact that they look for the talent first and then they see the rest. There were 1,000 people auditioning for the LAMDA program, the London Academy program. For this international program, only four women and 11 men. That was one thing that hadn't improved in the UK. They were only picking four women. And at my audition, I sang and I did my monologue. And then I explained that they saw underneath my tights there was something and they wanted to know about my legs. So I said I had I had had cancer, and I have a little plastic brace on under my tights. And they said that was marvelous because one of their graduates, who was a very successful actress, was Anna Calder Marshall, who I had seen on BBC shows that came over to America. I could see she had a bit of a limp. She had an interesting walk. But the fact is, she, because of, I think, polio, she couldn't feel from the knee down on her left leg. And that was me, not being able to feel anything from the knee down on my left leg. So I think I got in not just because they loved what I did, but they loved that I had a disability, which was an amazing thing. The dance teacher there did not love that I had a disability, and she got fired because of the way she treated me. That's another great thing about UK. Anyways, so I was lucky in each situation along the way. I had to learn how to walk again after my first surgery and go back to school and worked. And because training as an actor means a lot of body work, and even the voice work was a lot of body work because I lost my voice from the trauma of the first surgery. And my voice teachers at Carnegie Mellon were incredible. And the clown teacher, Mary Conway, unbelievable. The movement teachers, who was from Great Britain, everybody worked with me to help me re-educate my body and be re-educated by my body. And so I went back and was lucky enough that the London folks thought disability was a great idea. Not anywhere in America would you have heard that in an audition for having somebody to say, how wonderful, how fascinating. That was not my experience with American auditions, certainly not at that time in the late 70s. And so that was the first one. And the second one, after I lost my leg, I had a show to open. So once again, Keith, it's like I was l blessed with these things that were already in place. The gears were already moving as far as Carnegie Mellon. I was so close to graduating. I kept going, and I stayed through the summer and helped assistant teach the summer program for high school students. I did whatever it took. And when it turns out that I had to have my leg amputated in Boston, I had to relearn how to walk again. And in time to open a show. But this is what was so lucky, is that I had a goal. I had a show already in place when I found out that I had had a recurrence. And where some people would say, well, how do you know you could do this? I had a meeting in my hospital room with the stage manager, the musical director, and the cast. And I said, I've written out your schedule for the next 2 weeks because the physical therapy people said that I could get out of bed and go to a rehearsal 2 weeks from now. So here's what I want you to do with the musical director. I want you to get the music down for the next 2 weeks while I can't be there. And then I will be back and stage the rest of the show that I hadn't staged already. And I staged it on one leg. Because here's the thing, Keith. If you really want to do something, and you're lucky enough to have a deadline, to have a goal right in front of you, that you're not like going out there going, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself, but that you have something in front of you that has to happen by April 15th, or I have to be at rehearsals in 2 weeks. You're the luckiest person alive because you don't have too much time to feel sorry for yourself. You have to start learning, and you have to get it together. And it not to say that there wasn't an enormous amount of pain involved, but of course there is, because that was part of the deal. But the motivation to do something has been the greatest gift I was ever given from birth. The motivation to jump out of my crib was the same motivation was to get back up on stage, get back into the show, not get replaced, but actually do the work and get it done. And I think that that's taken me through my whole life. And it's interesting you're asking me these questions right now, because now I'm a lot older and a lot of things come up with age. People who had never had a disability, I know you're going to know what I'm talking about here, is people who have never dealt with disability in their life. When they get to my age, they just, for the first time in their life, experience disability. And I'm, of course, you know, sitting back with my arms folded, going, welcome to my world, people, you know. But I was lucky that I went through the disability shift that you're talking about, of like getting back into it and everything, early in my life when I had enormous amount of youthful energy as well. And when I moved from Boston, where I lost my leg in the show Jacques Brel, I moved down to New York, which was always my intent, but I didn't want to come here without a job. And I was offered a job at NYU, doing voice work with students at Experimental Theater Wing. The Experimental Theater Wing, which is one of the studios, undergrad studios at NYU Theater, the undergrad department. Because part of what I did in Boston to make money was vocal coach people. Because when I was at Carnegie Mellon and had cancer and lost my voice, the voice people there literally taught me how to build my voice back using my whole body. And I started using that approach on private students in Boston. And somebody heard about that. And they hired me to teach. And somebody was a teacher at NYU who was part of the program at Hampshire College, where I was out there teaching once a week or for a summer. And they introduced me to NYU. And I was like, oh, I can move to New York. But I have to tell you, Keith, people told me not to go to New York with one leg. Because if you go to New York thinking it's all going to work out and you have one leg, it's going to be a very rude awakening. Nobody's going to hire you. And that was like the opposite of what happened, because I was not going to let anybody not hire me. I'm not saying I didn't have an enormous amount of rejections, like total amount of rejections. And anyone who's disabled and is an actor and who lives in New York knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's like people can actually laugh you out of a room, or they can make you leave before you get to sing or do a monologue just by the way you walked into a room. That was the case in early 80s when I moved here. There were times when they wouldn't even let me open my mouth because of the way I walked into the room. They were like, thank you, but we are not looking for people like you. Bye. I know Rachel Handler, a wonderful young actress. I thought that, you know, was only in the 80s, but she's much younger. And she had an experience where people literally laughed at her when she said she's an amputee, when she talked about dancing. And this is all, there's always, I mean, being in this industry, there are going to be people who be cast, there's going to be auditions where people treat you badly, no matter what. If you're totally non-disabled, you have all of your limbs intact, you can do all the things that they require and they still treat you like crap. It's still bound to happen to anyone who has the gall to be in this industry for any amount of time. However, with a disability in the 80s and some of the 90s, I mean, it was tricky, but I was fortunate I did get work. Because I just, you know, in 1 month, I would do like 28 auditions. The month of February has 28 days. I did 28 auditions in February of one of the years that I was just pounding pavement all the time. And again, I knew that people stared at me on the street. I would wear my leg to auditions usually. But I was singing regularly at the improvisation, the comedy club, which there's the improvisation in LA. It started in New York, the original improvisation. And I was singing on stage. And when I got pregnant, I asked the owner if I could, I was the opening music act. I was having trouble wearing my leg during my pregnancy. And I said, would you mind if I just did the act without my leg, you know, just get on stage. And I wrote original songs, some of which ended up in Still Standing. She said, I don't care how many legs you have. And she was amazing. She's just get on stage and do your 10 minutes, do your set. And I did. And that ended up being what the Today Show decided to film, because they have me standing on stage on one leg, singing the song Here I Stand, which was the title song of Still Standing, on one leg. And it was funny enough to make people laugh, because at first when I would get on stage with one leg, I could see the men were all interested in this, but the women in the audience were like, looking down and holding their hand over their eyes, like they were very uncomfortable. But when I made people laugh as I was singing funny things, you could see the women my age in their 30s, very attractive women sitting in the club. They stopped hiding. They started actually looking at me and laughing because it was funny. And by the end of 10-minute set, they were totally won over. And that's what the Today Show kind of shows, that, and I gained my confidence to be exactly who I am. Instead of what people warned me about New York going, yeah, it holds up, New York holds a mirror up to you. You're going to see the reality of who you are now. And that was exactly what helped me, was that having one leg was fantastic. When you can change people's minds in a 10-minute music set in a comedy club that didn't people with people who didn't come to see you, they came to see Rodney Dangerfield and Robin Williams and Ray Romano and Cindy and Penny Marshall and those folks, they didn't come to see me. But if you can get them laughing and enjoying themselves and like cheering at the end of 10 minutes, you've just taught everybody in that room that having one leg just not only doesn't matter, but it's actually an asset. It makes you more creative and sometimes funnier because you know what's funny about having one leg. And writers who have written about disability thinking they know what's funny don't have a clue. And I've seen this time and time again, but when you have someone who actually has a disability and knows what's funny about their lives, it's a much more guaranteed laugh. You can nail it.
So tell me how you became the national chair of SAG-AFTRA Performers with Disabilities. And for those listeners who have no idea what that is, please tell us more.
Okay, so hang on one second. Okay, so I came to New York in 1983, and one of the first things I did, I started singing in cabarets almost right away because I went, not only did I start teaching at NYU, but at the same time I started working with all these composers and lyricists at BMI, and one of them hired me to do their show at Paulson's, a nightclub on 72nd Street. And I got great reviews. And this got me into the whole scene. I didn't have an equity card. I didn't have a SAG, a Screen Actors card, or an AFTRA card. I didn't have any union cards, but it was 1983. And someone who was on the Performers with Disabilities Committee that was meeting over at Equity in the union offices, they were meeting once a month or something. They saw what I was doing and that I had a disability, and they asked me to come to a meeting. And that was the beginning of my service to the unions, advocating for performers with disabilities. I walked into a room full of performers with disabilities who were frustrated because they couldn't get work. Nobody wanted them. Only one in the room was actually working in television, a young woman who was playing a daughter on one of these sitcoms. And she was fairly well known. But she and I, we didn't know each other, but she was the only one who was actually well known. But there were lots of people who had had a career and became disabled and they couldn't find work. So there was this committee at Equity. At the same time, there was a committee out at Screen Actors Guild in LA forming, which formed in actually 1980. But in 83, I was brought into this thing, this union stuff, not having gotten my card yet. But they let me into this committee because I was working. I was working non-equity. I wasn't yet equity. By 1986, I was a member of Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. And by 1988, I finally got the equity card. So now I was a member of all the unions. And at that point, I was recruited to be tri-union chair of the Performers with Disabilities Committee, which was across all three unions, because at that time there were three: equity, Screen Actors Guild, and AFTRA, which is American Federation of TV and Radio Artists. Later on, SAG and AFTRA came together, and they are now, for the past 10 years, have been SAG-AFTRA. So suddenly I was asked, or literally recruited, to be the chair of this committee. Now, at the time, I had felt, you know, these committees, people just get together and whine. They don't do anything. They don't change anything. It's like this support group where everybody comes to complain. But I was working through all of this. I was performing all the time, whether it was my cabaret act or doing summer stock, or I got into a show at the Public Theater. I mean, I was moving along. And that they said, that's why we want you to chair the committee. And at that point, the chair of the committee was an elderly actress who everybody loved. And when they replaced her with me, there was a lot of anger. It was like, who the heck are you? I'm like, I don't know. They just asked me to do this. And once we had one meeting and the people who were unhappy about it came to that meeting, they realized I was no nonsense. I was all business. It was like, okay, here's the agenda. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what we need to do. Here's what needs to happen. Here's what you need to do. Here's what I need to do. Here's what the union needs to do. And people started to notice that I was not letting anyone complain. If somebody started to whine or complain, I shut them down. It was mean, but it was like, sorry, that's not what we're doing here. It's not a bitch session. We have to make progress. We have an ear in the leadership of this union. And at that time, AFTRA was amazing. Because they had somebody on their national board, Kitty Lunn, who was the one who dragged me kicking and screaming into all of this. She was doing a soap. She had been cast in a Broadway show, but the day before she started rehearsals for the Broadway show as a dancer from Texas, she slipped on a piece of ice outside the ABC studios after just shooting an episode of a soap and never was able to walk again. Was in a wheelchair from then on. Well, she didn't waste any time. Once she was done with all the surgeries and all the difficulties and all the enormous challenges, she knew she wasn't going to be in that Broadway show. She knew she didn't know that they would ever cast her again in the soaps. But she was a dancer from a young age. So she started a dance company. She said, well, if I'm not going to be able to get that job or that job, I'm creating my own. And that was very much like what I was doing. If I'm not going to get work all the time, I have to create my own work. Very much like Nick Novicki in much later years in these 2010s said, if we're not going to get work enough work, we have to make the work. And he did the Disability Film Challenge. The thing is, Keith, when I was first recruited to do the work, I wasn't sure how we would do it, but I knew we had to work really hard together, not just me working, not just this person over here working. We needed to work together so that we show up more at auditions, have a greater presence, and get people to understand that talent has nothing to do with a disability. And by the time it came around to 2009, with the help of Ray Bradford, a staff member, incredible diversity member, staff member, and later Adam Moore, the three unions, again, I was the tri-union chair, we got ourselves together and we did a three-year campaign of the industry, and it was no holds bar. It was like, get these butts of these network people in seats. And around the same time, during those 3 years, I was on the negotiating committee for SAG and AFTRA for the TV theatrical contract. And they had me go speak to the Hollywood producers one-on-one, like right there at the table, explaining why it was important that we get this in writing in the contract, that you can't discriminate against performers because of a disability. And if you've got a role that has a disability, all the more reason that you have to at least see performers with disabilities audition. And it was more and more came of that 3-year campaign, my watchdog report, reporting on where we were showing up and where we weren't showing up, and where it was inauthentic casting, where it was authentic casting in TV, film, live theater, broadcasting, recording artists, everything. And I think that's when the momentum was really going. And I know a lot of organizations and a lot of advocacies in the industry have sprung from that time and kept going. And I've kept being the chair all these years. But it really did start back in the 80s. And so now I have officially served in my unions as an advocate for performers with disabilities. And this fall, I've decided that I'm going to retire from the chair position, to let a new generation take it over, because there are people. I had to wait until I knew there were people who could really do it. And I can't say these names right now because it's not official. But what's fabulous is watching a generation of people who are really grabbing the bull by the horns. I'm known as the Velvet Hammer because I got what we got, by not being angry, but by saying we could work together on this and we'll both benefit. Your sponsors will get more money if your TV shows have somebody representing the disability community, because we're like a quarter of the population, and there's so much money to be spent. Everyone's going to be more happy. And in theater as well, more butts in seats at live theater because you included someone with a disability in that cast. Everyone, they want to come in droves. They're going to come and watch those shows. You have a deaf actor in your show, you're going to have a deaf audience. You're going to have people coming. And that's money. And really, all does come down to money in the industry, anyways. So I'm happy to say that these 40 years, I've been able to leave a legacy. And that doesn't mean I stop advocating, because I will continue to advocate. But I advocated the Real Abilities Film Festival by being on the selection committee of the films. And I entered the Dramatist Guild. I work with playwrights and writers with disabilities. And I teach a class about writing inclusively with disability. And so I never really stopped. But I'm very proud that I've been the chair of that committee, and that I've done as much service as I possibly can for my unions. And I have been on the picket line these past few weeks too.
So, speaking of the next generation, if there are any advocates who are just getting their feet wet, so to speak, in professional advocacy or acting or writing or any way advocacy, what would be some action steps that you would give them?
Right. Well, showing up in every possible way, showing up. If you're in the unions already, which not everybody is, but if you are, when you get the survey you get every 2 years in August that says, "Do you want to be on a committee?" You write that you want to be on the committee. Not everybody's able to get on the committee because it's got limits to numbers, but you have to tell people, yes, you have to check the box and tell them anything that helps them to make the decision to put you on the committee. So that's for union members, particularly SAG-AFTRA members. That's how it works. Equity is a bit different, but you get involved in any way you can. And you could actually get involved in any committee on any of the unions, just to be showing up as a performer with a disability, showing up and being in the room, whether it's legislative committee or communications committee or in every single aspect of the union. Accessibility is important on every committee. So showing up and being present and visible in those cases is important. And I would also apply that to everything else. As you know, there are organizations out there already. If you look on Facebook, just type in disability, particularly you could say disability or performers with disabilities. There are so many organizations now that are advocating you get involved, and you could start by getting involved on social media, commenting, saying things, and going to meetings that are about casting or that are about, I mean, I have a mailing list of people who I, whatever comes to me saying, hey, there's a town hall at blah, 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 blah. Doesn't have to be a union person. Just any performer with a disability can show up. I send it out to my mailing list, my email list. So you can always, if you want to get on my, if you are a performer with a disability, you could get on my emailing list at anitahollander@hotmail.com, and you can get on that. You just say you want to be on my contact, my performers with disabilities list. When I get a casting notice that isn't something for me, but the Casting Society of America sends me things because I worked with them all these years too. They're going, we can't find this certain type of actor with a disability. Please let's help us with the search. Then I send it out to my mailing list. And if you happen to be one of those people that you'd be right for it, that's your way of saying, I am right for this. Of course, you can't abuse that by submitting yourself for something you're not authentically right for. That would not be a good step, and that would be a don't on the do's and don'ts. But you start to, if there's a workshop or a seminar, I'm sending that out. If I get the information on it, I'm sending it back out. And on Facebook, there are so many, you know this, there's so many things, trained professional performers with disabilities, I think, is one of the Facebook groups. If you just look up disability performer groups on Facebook, just go. I know I send a lot of stuff out that I see on one of those groups. I send it out to my people. Just that gets you in the loop. And social media wasn't around for the bulk of when I've done all this work. We didn't have anything like that. So that's why it took us a long time to get what we needed. When I went before the Hollywood producers in those negotiations in 2010, there was a lot less social media participation in the disability community. But Ali Stroker was one of our committee members who said, we need to be more present on social media. And it was early on with all that stuff. And she was like, all right, come in here and tell us what to do. I loved having her on the committee. And this was before anybody knew who she was. I mean, what I mean is before she had all of the successful jobs, before Glee, before the Glee Project, and before Oklahoma on Broadway, before any of those things. We had met because we both had performed at the same theater in New Jersey. And I said, please be on our committee. And we'd met in LA when I was out there for one of our board meetings. And she came on board the bandwagon, and she was really instrumental in saying, we can't do anything without getting involved in social media. We have to do that. So there are now workshops at all the major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS. And if you keep an eye on these social media pages, those announcements are there, and you can get into it. Now, if you're not like trying to get jobs as a performer with disability, but you want to be behind the camera, there's Lights, Camera, Access. You should look up that one, Terry Hartman Squire's group. Who has through the years, as many years as I've been at this, she has actually been a few years before with Justin Dart and the making of the ADA. And she gets people together behind the cameras, works, has been working at that long before organizations like Respectability came along. She was like the mother of getting studios to look at directors, writers, producers with disabilities, camera people, crew members. And she's done seminars and workshops. The Real Abilities Film Festival is a fabulous way to get your toe into the water, because if you happen to have a toe or maybe your little finger, but you go to that festival every year in April. There's one whole day devoted through in the whole week of showing films. There's one whole day devoted to networking, getting in there and meeting with other people. And even if you're not a performer and you don't want to, you're not even in the industry, but you want to be an advocate, going to these things, meeting people, talking to people, networking with people can get you in there, because I've found it to be a very welcoming community. Everybody wants more people on board, because the more of us that are on board doing whatever it takes, whether spreading the word or making a film for the Disability Film Challenge, you'll hear about all these things by showing up at Real Abilities Film Festival here in New York, or any of the other cities: Houston, Dallas, Chicago, Detroit, LA, Denver, Atlanta, Boston, anywhere where there is a union office or any kind of filmmaking or television or theater, there are Real Abilities branches. So you go to one of these things and you get to know people. I also did a lot of crazy things, like there is a government office for employment of people with disabilities, and I got really friendly with Kathy Martinez, who was at one time the head of that department, and she was blind, and she would come out to LA a lot because she started her career as a blind actress on TV, and as a kid, and she was doing a listening tour all through the country. And one of her stops was Boston, but she wasn't doing a New York stop. So I got on a bus and went to Boston to speak in the listening tour. And she knew me because she had seen me perform. And she said, after I did my little speech, my little advocating speech, she said, "Sing me one of your songs. Sing 'Here I Stand.'" A cappella, as part of this listening tour, I sang the song for her. And she's like, "I just needed to hear that song." And this was because I showed up. These are all because, yeah, I can get on a bus, go up to Boston, and then get on a bus and come home. But if for 5 minutes I can advocate for employment for people with disabilities by telling even a tiny bit of my story, and it really was, I know you won't believe this because I talk too much, but 5 minutes, I encapsulated what needed to be heard. And it helped. It helped to stimulate employers who are looking and saying, "Oh, wow, that wasn't bad at all. She's actually capable, and she's we should probably interview some people with disabilities, because if they're like her, I mean, we're going to have a lot of interesting employees. So am I making did I make my point, Keith?
Yet you did very well. Wrapping up, I like to think that not only people with disabilities listen to this podcast, but people who haven't discovered their disabilities yet.
Yes.
What do you hope that people with disabilities take away from this episode? And what do you hope that people who haven't discovered their disabilities yet take away from this episode? And lastly, if a person wants to know more about you, how can they reach out to you, or do you have a website?
Great. Okay, so for the PWDs, I would say the most important thing I can say is show up. Show up. Look for places to show up and be visible. If you're a performer, go to those auditions. Unfortunately, there are plenty of non-equity and non-union auditions, like independent films that are like tiny low budgets. Get yourself on film by saying yes to a low budget film that won't pay you, but you will get on film and you will have a reel so that you'll have something to show people. Take advantage of every opportunity and show up. The more of us who show up and be visible, the better it will be for all of us. For non-PWDs who are yet to be disabled, look at the advantages of advocating for people with disabilities, realizing that you may benefit from advocating later in your life, at any moment in your life. Like I was, my perfect example is breaking my hand within a split second on 42nd Street in front of Ripley's, believe it or not, just one slip of the crutch and I was down with a broken hand. Could happen to absolutely anyone, anywhere, at any time. So if you are advocating for people with disabilities, whether it's for jobs of any kind or for just for casting, for any, if you advocate for others who have disabilities, you will benefit, you will reap the benefits 100% in your own life when something happens to you. And I say when, because something happens to everybody. I mean, that may not be a permanent thing, but you may find yourself disabled even temporarily. You're going to experience something you never experienced before. But if you've been advocating, if you've been supporting the disability community in whatever way, you're going to reap those benefits yourself. So you're investing in your own future. That, I think, would be the most important thing I would say. And I know non-disabled actors who have advocated for disabled actors at auditions. My favorite one is Matt Jaeger, years ago, non-deaf actor, but who knows how to sign, came in and auditioned for a role, for a TV role, and said, look, I'm here, I'm auditioning, but the truth is you need to see Troy Kotsur. Troy Kotsur, who was relatively unknown, and this was years ago, CODA was way in the future. He was not well known. He was part of Deaf West. And Matt said, you got to see this guy for this role. He's actually deaf and he's going to be the right guy for the role. And Troy got that role. And forever, I have told people about that story because Matt, in the end, Matt did benefit because the goodwill he showed, sacrificing a job to get someone else the audition, got him more work in the long run. So invest in your future. Contact AnitaHollander.com. That's my website, AnitaHollander.com. There is a button to press for contact me. So you don't even need to know the email that I mentioned. You just contact me, write me an email on the contact me, and I will put you on. Just tell me you're a performer with a disability, or you're a writer with a disability, or artist with a disability, whatever. You have a disability and you want to be on my contact list. I will put you on it. So www.AnitaHollander, AnitaHollander.com.
Well, Anita, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing some amazing stories. A lot of them I had no clue. I feel like I know you so much better than I did even a few hours ago, and I feel very privileged and honored to call you a friend and mentor. Thank you so much.
Keith, I just have to throw in a big thank you to you, because there are moments in a person's life when they feel, I don't know, just a little down. And you kind of brought me back to life today. So thank you. Thank you so much, Keith. You're the best.
Thank you. See you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.